artists. Each episode, we will be breaking down a different production, a movie, TV show, whatever we're feeling like. And this week, to continue our Lord of the Rings series, we watched the first of the, I guess, Hobbit franchise, The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. My name is Danielle, and here are the mad artists I have with me to help break this down today. Why did you do that into the mic, you heathen? It's your turn.
Oh,
no,
I thought you looked at him.
No.
Hi, everyone. It's Samuel. I know I always start. I should know that by now.
Yes.
Hey, everyone. It's John.
And Rick.
Yeah, if you can't tell, I think we're a little tired tonight. It's already off to a rocky start. Well, I know we've all seen this before, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Nope. Who all saw this in theaters?
Nope.
Hello.
Hello.
So, Samuel
Midnight
and Rick.
Midnight premiere, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Fun fact, in the same summer, I binged The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings, and the whole Harry Potter series in one summer.
Yeah, that was summer, what was that, like summer 2020?
Something summer 2019? Like, 2019? I think it was 2019.
So you watched this when all three were out?
Yes, I pretty much set aside, I went through Lord of the Rings first, and then I think the following day I went through The Hobbit. Well, I say the next day, probably 2 days later, but...
Okay.
But yeah.
So you watched this way after it came out.
Yeah, and I think I actually watched it,
Oh my god. That's the greatest thing I've ever seen.
Oh my goodness.
I need it for this.
Oh no.
Everyone here is of age, but that was the funniest thing I've ever seen, was just spiking the drink while we talk. Incredible. Oh my gosh, that was amazing. Oh, that was so good.
But no, yeah, and I think if I remember correctly, I watched it in order. So I watched The Hobbit through to the end of The Lord of the Rings. Yep. Is the way I watched it.
Interesting. So you watched Hobbit before Lord of the Rings?
Yes.
Fun fact, so did I.
That's not true.
It is absolutely
insane.
True.
Really?
Because The Hobbit came out in 2012.
Yeah?
I was allowed to read the book The Hobbit long
you
before.
You were 12 in 2012.
Long before I was allowed to read Lord of the Rings. I did not watch Lord of the Rings until 2014, but I saw this at the midnight premiere.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So this was your first
absolutely
exposure
wild
to Peter Jackson's direction of live action, the Tolkien universe.
Correct.
Oh, we got some dogs outside.
Who let the dogs
out? So I guess I'm most curious to know about your response to this then.
I mean, when I watched it when I was 12, I loved it.
Absolutely loved
it. And I've only seen it a couple of times since, and it's probably been, I mean, gosh, it's probably been 5 or 6 years since I've seen them.
This was my second time watching it, because I've only watched each of these one time. And it was every time they came out on, I want to say DVD, my dad would buy it and then sit us all down and make us all watch it. and at that time,
you
I wasn't,
watch
yes, at that time, I wasn't the biggest fan of Lord of the Rings. I hadn't been able to finish it because I just didn't understand what was happening. And my dad was trying to explain it, but he was a little long-winded with his explanations, and so we would end up pausing every 5 minutes for about 20 minutes. And so I just kind of gave up after a while. love you, Dad. But then with this movie, I kind of just didn't bother asking questions. I knew I was going to be confused. I knew I probably really wasn't going to care. And I just noticed the attractive dwarf and watched him the entire time. and was just like, hey, he's back on screen. Like, and I always liked Gollum. Gollum was my favorite as a kid. And so when he popped back up, I was like, hey, I know that guy. But other than that, like, this was the first time watching it since I read the book. Because I read the book a couple years ago. And I really liked the book. And this was my first time watching it since then, so I was like, oh, you know, and I didn't remember anything that happened in this movie. I thought this was the one where Smaug shows up, because apparently I didn't really start paying attention to these movies until Smaug showed up, clearly.
Yeah, I saw this in theaters,
Midnight premiere?
I did not go to the midnight premiere, but I actually took off work to go see it like at noon on the Friday with a buddy of mine. And he called me that morning and something had happened and he couldn't go. So I went by myself to this movie, so hyped after after the live action Lord of the Rings and
right.
And yeah, so
and that's all you want to say about that?
That's all I have to say about that.
Well, this one came out, as we've said, in 2012. It was directed by Peter Jackson, written by Fran Walsh, Philippa Boyens, and Peter Jackson, based on the books by Tolkien, and stars Martin Freeman as Bilbo Baggins, Sir Ian McKellen as Gandalf the Grey, and Richard Armitage as Thorin Oakenshield. You can watch this with a Max, Prime Video, or Hulu Premium subscription, or you can buy or rent it on Vudu, Apple TV, and Google Play. And the IMDb summary for this says, a reluctant hobbit, Bilbo Baggins, sets out to the Lonely Mountain with a spirited group of dwarves to reclaim their mountain home and the gold within it from the dragon Smaug.
So I have a little bit on our production team here. We've talked at length about Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh and Philippa Boyens, so I'm not going to go into them at all, but rather I'm going to go into the story behind the production of this and something that just explains the whole trilogy to me in a lot of ways. So originally, this was the passion project of Guillermo del Toro.
Mm.
And
a very different director.
Production was started by Guillermo del Toro with Peter Jackson on merely to produce it. He was producing it, Fran Walsh and Philippa Boyens were writing the script, and Guillermo del Toro was supposed to direct it. In May of 2010, due to financing problems, Guillermo del Toro left the picture.
Mm.
And this is Peter Jackson's quote about it. Because Guillermo had to leave and I had to jump in and take over, we didn't wind the clock back a year and a half to give me time to prep and design the movie, which was different to what he was doing. It was impossible, and as a result of it being impossible, I just started shooting the movie with it not prepped at all. You're going on to set, and you're having to wing it. You've got these massively complicated scenes, no storyboards, and you're making it up on the spot.
It's Star Wars.
I mean, it explains it for sure. I mean, this wasn't his passion project. This wasn't what he wanted to do.
Yep.
And he didn't have time to do everything he needed to do as far as pre-production. So it's like, you're just getting thrown in, and you're like, all right, so the show is already halfway done. Go ahead and finish it. I can't even imagine. Before we get into breaking down the plot of this movie, does anyone have any kind of broad stroke stuff that they want to go over before we just dive in here? I can see Rick is thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Coming off of the high of Return of the King and how, what's the right word I'm looking for? True that the Lord of the Ring treatment was to the source material.
Yeah.
And then walking out of the theater after this thinking, what just happened? It was just like, I was like, okay, maybe it'll be okay. I just feel like The Hobbit, the book, was a simple, straightforward tale. It was an adventure. It was just a very simple adventure there and back again.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow whoever it was, decided to force these three movies to be a direct prequel to The Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Rather than it just being its own story. They forced so much stuff into this that they really didn't need to, that it made it less of a movie. It was the opposite of Lord of the Rings, where they took some stuff out. They had to take some stuff out
mm-hmm.
to make that work as a movie. And they added a bunch of stuff into this movie and made it fail as a story.
I have a couple of thoughts on that. I agree with the broad strokes of, I think that that's the big failing of this trilogy. Where I struggle is that I actually don't see a good way around it where the movie could have been commercially successful. And that's part of the difficult thing. And there's also precedence with this story of that happening, because The Hobbit, as we know it today, none of us have actually read The Hobbit. We have read The Hobbit after Lord of the Rings. because Tolkien went back and rewrote pretty wide
swaths of the Hobbit. Yeah, because it was originally just the series of letters to Christopher, right?
Well, it was a book that he published, and it did very well commercially, but it was very much a children's book. And after Lord of the Rings came out and was so successful, he went back and rewrote entire portions of the book to make it fit with the Lord of the Rings world. Riddles in the Dark was pretty... Everything with Gollum was changed quite a bit from the original writing, which none of us have read, because that's not what's
not available.
Imprinted.
Yeah.
That's not what's in print. What's in print is the updated version from, like, 1950 or whatever, after Lord of the Rings came out. So I think that there is an amount of precedence for it, but I guess I have sympathy for the filmmakers, because I do feel like their hands were tied a little bit.
Well,
because if they just adapt the books, if they just adapt the book, it comes out as something much more akin to Alice in Wonderland or The Chronicles of Narnia, and it feels nothing like Lord of the Rings, and the thousands and thousands of fans who are only familiar with Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings would walk out and be like, what was that? And would not go and see anything else.
Well, and
the only way that they do that right is if they just make it one film.
Which would have been much better. But to your last point there, my mother never read the book. I think she might have. I don't think she ever read The Hobbit. She did read Lord of the Rings at one point, but she loved these films. She loved the Lord of the Rings movies. She watched these. She thought they were great. I know other people that have no background in Tolkien love these movies. But.
Well, I know a big thing that has kind of destroyed a lot of what could have been successful endings to a lot of franchises was what Harry Potter and, you know, Hunger Games and everyone, and, you know, even Twilight kind of started, which is we have to split everything into as many movies as possible. Now, for the last Harry Potter movie, it actually made sense because it was a gigantic book with so much stuff, you had to split it down the middle, or else you wouldn't get the whole story. Even, and people can cringe about this, but even Twilight, to an extent, I understand why they split it in half. The book is split in half. The book is part one and part two, so it makes sense.
This is even something that's on the minds of the cultural zeitgeist at the moment, because Dune. Right? Dune part one and Dune part two are one book split into two.
Yeah. And so, all that to say, you know, they looked at the success of, you know, and granted, Lord of the Rings is different because, you know, yes, it is all one book, but there were three books, so three movies makes sense. And and then, so it made sense to do multiple movies and to have this big epic trilogy. And I feel like, you know, I do think the filmmakers' hands were tied because, you know, the studio was like, well, we have to do the same thing. We have to do another epic trilogy that, you know, that looks as good and is as action-packed and all crazy to be the prequel. And that's not what the story was ever meant to be. Now, did I hate it? No. But that's just because, for me, while I enjoyed the book, the book The Hobbit, I didn't mind a more, I guess you could call it, mature interpretation of it. I look at this as more of, like, not a direct adaptation, but, like, an interpretation. Yeah. And that's how I can be, like, okay with it, is I look at it instead of a direct representation. This is an interpretation with some fluff.
Which, something that we'll get into, and this is just kind of my last overarching thought before we dive in, something that we'll get into is I actually feel like this movie is not the biggest offender. I feel like
it gets much worse.
Yeah, it gets much worse. This movie is...
It's like the Star Wars sequels.
This movie is not that offensive in terms of the adaptation. They stick relatively close to the book in this one. Really, the main difference is that the addition of Azog. And that's really the only big difference between the book and this film. 2 and 3 divulge so much that it's almost not even the same story.
Yeah. The things that they added to this story, for the most part, exist somewhere in Tolkien lore.
Yes.
They were never part of this story.
Yeah. Well, right. Like, I get all the Gandalf stuff that they do in these movies. I'm actually totally on board with all that because that's straight from the appendixes. That is what Gandalf was doing. I'm totally fine with all of that. The big thing... I mean, in this movie, the big addition is Azog, because that's just not a thing anywhere.
He was already dead.
Yep.
Well, does anyone else have any overarching thoughts before we dive in?
I had a blast. You know, maybe it's because I'm not burdened with the knowledge of Tolkien lore. that I can blissfully watch an adventure with cheesy humor and a bunch of dwarves. And to be told, it was fun seeing going from, you know, the world of elves and man in Lord of the Rings to actually get a little slice of what the other half of Tolkien's world building was like. And I just had fun exploring that. And, you know, dwarves!
To be honest...
I mean, all we get in Lord of the Rings is dead ones.
Oh, that's fair. including and, one of these. But no, I actually agree with you. Even though I read the book, you know, I'm not as intense of a, you know, Lord of the Rings fanatic as these two. And so my fanaticism sticks with mostly Harry Potter. And so, you know, I get where you're coming from where, you know, I kind of knew where things were differing and branching off. But I wasn't super burdened with knowing exactly what just happened. So I'm just like, oh, okay, you know, like, this is a fun adventure. I can kind of turn off the literary criticism side of my brain and just enjoy it. And also enjoy the performances because the actors were doing a fantastic job. Martin Freeman as Bilbo is incredible. He is so good. He has the most just, like, subtle comedy that was... I was cackling. Like, every time they just showed him on screen, I started laughing, and Samuel would just look over like, he's not even doing anything. And I'm like, he doesn't have to. Like, he's so subtle, and it's hilarious. But we'll go ahead and dive in, and I'm sure they will interrupt me immediately. Approaching his 111th birthday, 111st, I always forget, the Hobbit Bilbo Baggins begins writing the story of his adventures 60 years earlier for his nephew Frodo.
I will go and stop you there, because one of the first comments that I had in this movie that I said to Danielle when we were watching it the other night was, I forgot how long that prologue portion is.
15 minutes.
Of...
quite
long. And that was the first moment where I looked at Danielle and I said, I forgot how much they had to add in. Because they just had to fill runtime. I mean, none of that was necessary.
Correct.
At all to the movie.
Well, because...
It's all context that we already have from Lord of the Rings. We don't need it again. And it was just like, oh, hey, look, here's Elijah Wood as Frodo. And that's really it. It's just 15 minutes of completely unnecessary stuff.
And I kind of think that was a studio thing. Was like, we have to have Elijah Wood here. Like,
yeah. The audience is stupid.
We have to show them.
Yeah. Was it, and I forget, I mean, I watched this thing in the last couple of days, but did they do the whole dwarf, the Erebor backstory too in that first 15 minutes?
Yeah.
It's like, they could easily have worked that in later.
I mean, it was a long intro. It was
or
long.
Which I think they were just trying to copy the Lord of the Rings intro, right?
Fair. Yeah.
If you want to do that, just stick
to... I was there 3,000 years ago.
Just stick to the Erebor stuff.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to go into all the Bilbo stuff and all the Frodo stuff. Just give us the Erebor backstory and then jump, you know, have a... Here's the Erebor backstory, you know, 50 years later... 60 years before Lord of the Rings, and then we're good to go. Maybe have a little two-minute scene with Ian Holm as Bilbo sitting down, oh, I'm going to write my story, and then flashback 60 years ago. Bam.
I will say I did like the shift from old Bilbo on the bench to young Bilbo on the bench. I did like that kind of representation of his very just kind of like stagnant lifestyle. Like, it's been the same since he was however old he is in The Hobbit. That it's been the same. 50? Yeah, 50-something. Yeah.
About my age.
Yeah. but that he's had the exact same routine that whole time. I liked that just creatively. I was like, oh, okay, that's a cool little, like, shift. That is literally the exact same place. He's wearing the same clothes. He's smoking the same pipe. Like, for me, I thought that was a cool way of representing that. But also, we still didn't need the entire 15 minutes of them talking. But again, you know, that does track, again, with kind of all the buffing of movies of the time, where they're like, we have to make this a trilogy to make it sell as well as
and
the original
movie
one.
It has to be 2 hours and 30 minutes plus long.
We have to fit into the exact, like, you know, We have to fit into the exact mold that the original trilogy made. But this book, if you've read it, it's not even that long of a book. No. It's a short book.
Well, and there's also a reason that we're not doing the extended editions of these. I watched them once, and I was like, I'm never doing that again. They add nothing. They only make it worse.
Oh, my. I have the extended edition of this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because I remember getting the extended edition box set, hoping that it would, like, hey, maybe...
Enrich.
Maybe this will make it better. It did not.
I don't know. I thought the Good Morning bit was enjoyable.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's what I was saying, is that whole bit... Well, because when Gandalf shows up, that's when the story starts.
Yeah, the Good Morning bit was fabulous. That was word for word from the book, acted perfectly.
That was one of my notes, was that I do appreciate Peter Jackson and the writers lifting dialogue directly from the book. That's...
In spite of the lighting being a little cursed on Ian McKellen, but that was something I was noticing through a lot of the movie, that because of his hat, and I didn't notice this with the original trilogy, but light... was, like, shining in his eyes so clearly, like, to where he almost looked like, you haven't seen Midnight Mass.
Yes, sir.
You have. You know how their eyes, like, glow? That's almost what he looked like. And my explanation to him, because he was like, because I was like, why does he look weird? And he was like, yeah, his eyes are, like, glowing. And I was like, he must be holding reflectors down low to, like, put light on his face. But, like, usually movie creators are good at not creating those pinpricks unless it's for a purpose. And so I was just, like, shocked how much I was seeing it.
Just, I mean, I'm pretty sure that vampires are canon in Tolkien universe. So
it's been confirmed. Maybe Gandalf is a vampire.
Gandalf is a vampire. Explain a lot.
Spoilers from Midnight Mass.
Whoops. But continuing on, so long before Bilbo's involvement, the dwarf King Thror brought an era of prosperity for his kin under the Lonely Mountain until the arrival of the dragon Smaug. Smaug destroyed a nearby town of Dale, drove the dwarves out of their mountain, and took their hoard of gold. Thror's grandson, Thorin, sees King Thranduil and his wood elves on a nearby hillside and is dismayed when they leave rather than aid his people, resulting in Thorin's everlasting hatred of elves. In the Shire, 50-year-old Bilbo is tricked by the wizard Gandalf the Grey into hosting a dinner for Thorin and his company of dwarves, Balin, Dwalin, Fili, Kili, Dori, Nori, Ori, Owen, Glowin, Biffer, Bofer, and Bomber.
this whole sequence, in my opinion, was pretty fantastic.
It was good, and as I was watching it, I just turned to Samuel and was like, this is my nightmare. is a huge group of people showing up unannounced, destroying my house, and demanding that I host them. I'm pretty sure I've had a nightmare akin to that.
This is one of the probably one of the highest points of the movie for me was the dwarven singing.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That was awesome.
That was great.
The second one especially, but even the
Misty Mountains
chip
theme,
the plates and all that stuff. That was great.
His says will blunt the knife.
No, I noticed as the movie went on that the Misty Mountains was like really one of the only themes that would ever play. Like every now and then we would get another theme, but very rarely. And I mentioned it to Samuel and he was like, cause it's a good theme. And I was like, here's the thing. I'm not even mad about it. It's just like, I didn't remember it being like that in the original trilogy, but like then I pointed it out and it's just everywhere.
Once you pointed it out, I couldn't unhear it. Anytime.
Anytime.
Anything epic happens. It's dun, 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 dun.
Like it's specifically anything epic involving the dwarves. Like, which is most of the movie. And so, like, anytime...
There's an epic retelling of just that exact suite.
Yes. Just that over and over and over. And I was like, here's the thing, it's a great theme, but it was just over and over again and again.
Well, and there are two moments where I'm pretty sure it's the exact same orchestration used in the exact same way. It's when the dwarves attack the trolls, and then when they attack Azog at the end. When, you know, both times where, you know, somebody's facing down Bilbo and then the dwarves come into the rescue out of nowhere. It's the same exact orchestration of that theme both times.
But also it plays just when they're traveling. Like, when we're just watching the dwarves go across the land, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Like, anytime we see the dwarves on screen, they're like, also, this is the dwarf theme. And I'm like, okay, like, we know.
These are dwarves, in case you hadn't known.
In case you couldn't tell, these are dwarves.
It's like they're me in a D&D session.
Yes! Anytime a character does something, he plays that character's theme. But yes, 100%. So continuing on, Gandalf's aim is to recruit Bilbo, recruit Bilbo as the company's burglar to aid them in their quest to enter the Lonely Mountain. Bilbo is unwilling to accept at first, but has a change of heart after the company leaves without him the next day.
Oh, while I'm thinking about it, because we met Thorin for the first time, which Richard Armitage does a great job as Thorin, he's almost exactly what I imagine from the books. But I will say it was a very bold design choice that I did not notice until this time around. I noticed it with Keely on the first watch through, but this is the first time I've really noticed to take the main dwarf and have him barely have a beard.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is a choice. Like, very and not weird. One that I particularly like all that much.
I mean, to me, it seemed like the two dwarves that they were like, the ladies will like these dwarves. They just, like, took their beards away and were like, they're just going to have maybe a little scruff and, like, some long hair, and that'll be enough. That's at least the only way that I can, you know.
And then meanwhile, you get dwarves like the king, I forget his name.
Thror? Yeah.
Where he was, like, completely, like, full prosthetics and everything.
Oh, yeah.
But, no, Richard Armitage, not. You gotta see that man's whole face.
No. I did, this was always, even when I first watched it, just, I don't know why, but, like, an uplifting moment of the movie is just him, like, running out of the house and, like, tearing down the path. And he's like, I'm going on an adventure! Like, running down. Even the first time I watched it, it just made me smile. I just enjoyed
it. And on this time around, that was where the movie... And I loved that moment, but for me, that's where the movie took a pretty sharp turn.
Like, after, or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was... Yeah, I mean, we'll get to some of my criticisms of some of the later stuff, but... I was really looking forward because I remembered liking this one. And up to that point, watching it the other night, I was like, okay, this is holding up. And then almost immediately after this is when it just started.
Yeah, there is a particular scene that I will, when we get to it.
I think my favorite part is just, like, with that heavy of an ensemble cast, is that each dwarf had their own sense of individuality. You tell each character was worked on very well. And that's what I kind of liked. Like, no, like, dwarf was the exact same as the one next to it.
Yeah.
And I felt that was, because I think with this kind of movie, it'd be very easy just to kind of, you know...
They might like, be the dwarves.
Just the dwarves.
Yeah, they're all going to be brash and loud, and they're all going to act like Gimli.
Exactly. And I feel like that was a nice, like, touch and differentiation from, like, you know, where we get Gimli, who is constantly grumpy, complaining, sweet, but for the most part with a facade of, you know, gruffness. Meanwhile, you get, you know, like, softer, kind-hearted dwarves. I'd have to point them out in the movie. I can't remember their names off the top of my dome. But there's plenty of, like, nicer dwarves. There was some... gruffer dwarves like Thorin and Dwalin that were, you know, I thought it was a nice rounded ensemble cast and not one, like, overlapped each other.
Yeah, and to be honest, that's probably a testament to the actors and the work they did. Yes, kind of absolutely. in the pre-production process. Not saying that Peter Jackson didn't offer any sort of help, but because he came in later, that was probably mostly them being like, we have to each be individual, you know?
And it helps that they casted a lot of good actors.
Oh, yeah.
As the dwarves.
A lot of good actors.
My boy James Nesbitt.
Who is that again?
Bofur. Exactly, one of my favorite actors.
Yeah, he was throwing out, like, actor names, and I was like, you gotta tell me which one it is. Like, you gotta point to him on screen, because they got prosthetics on. I'm not recognizing anybody. So he races to join them. Traveling onward, the company is captured by three trolls. Now, that's kind of a jump ahead, because originally they capture the ponies, And then on trying to save the ponies, Bilbo gets snatched, and then all the dwarves come in and they all get captured. But Bilbo stalls the trolls from eating them until dawn, and Gandalf exposes the trolls to sunlight, turning them to stone. One thing I actually did, and I commented on this to Samuel while we were watching, like, maybe not, maybe this is just me because, you know, I'm not as, like, in, I guess, buried in the Tolkien world, but I actually liked that we got to see a little more of Gandalf's magic and power in this than in the original trilogy, because he would show up and he would do some cool stuff, but it was always in a very vague, like, mm-hmm. what are you actually doing kind yeah. of thing. And I like that we got to see a little more of his actual, like,
power.
Yeah, a little more of his, when he is part of a team and not just gathering one together, like, what does he do? And I did like that difference.
I think that's a treat we got to get throughout this series, is just the overall use of just magic as a whole is a little more defined versus the nuance that it has in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, which for me, since I love seeing cool magic, I was a big fan of. I really liked it.
Ass.
Oh yeah, I liked it.
Yeah, there. I don't think it was at this point, but it was another point later in the movie, speaking of Gandalf and
yeah.
magic, where I said, is this the first time we've actually seen him do a spell?
Yeah.
It might have been with the pine cones. Or...
He was doing a bunch of crazy stuff with pine cones, yeah.
Which is straight out of the books.
No, I get that. But to Danielle's point a minute ago, it's like, typically it's just, it happens. It's,
yeah.
It's like an organic thing. We don't see him chanting or
right.
waving his fingers.
Yeah, like not
whatever.
Doing a thing. It's just, and magic happens, yeah. you know? Which I liked in this movie, we actually saw him work, you mm-hmm. know? Like, even when he...
Bit.
When he broke the stone, he had to, like, slam his staff mm-hmm. down. It didn't just fall apart underneath
right.
him. Which I thought was a cool little difference. To also show kind of the difference in time, the difference in, like, the power structure and, you know, everything. The company locates the troll's cave and finds treasure and elven blades. Thorin and Gandalf each take an elf-made blade, Orcrist and Glamdring, respectively. Gandalf gives an elven dagger to Bilbo. Which, what I said to Samuel is, Glamdring is the best sword onomatopoeia of all time. Like, it sounds like two swords clashing. Yeah, it sounds like two swords clashing together, and I just absolutely love that name. It's so awesome. It feels so good just, like, to say.
You should narrate audiobooks.
Yeah, you know, like, probably not, though. I probably won't be very good at it. But the wizard Radagast the Brown finds Gandalf and the company. Oh, I'm strapping in. And recounts an encounter at Dol Guldur with the necromancer, a sorcerer who has been corrupting Greenwood with dark magic. And I'll turn it over to Rick's deep sigh.
this is my point where it completely went off the rails.
Okay.
Well,
okay, before we get there, Samuel, why was the trolls where it went off the rails for you?
The troll scene did not work for me.
Really?
Not like it did in the books. They changed some things in a weird way. They actually made Bilbo's role less significant.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
He did a lot more in the book.
They made... The way that the trolls were so loud, and yet, like, they find the horses are missing, and, oh yeah, they were sitting here watching the horses, and they're, like, three trees down. How did you miss that? And then they're walking towards the troll camp, and then a second later, the troll walks back carrying two more horses, and it's like, how did you miss that? Like, it's
that
just
is true.
So completely...
Yeah.
And then the actual scene itself, like, was just, they kind of, like, stripped so much of what Bilbo did good in the books away.
Mm-hmm.
That I did actually notice.
That's when he really became the burglar.
Yeah.
Because he was doing all this deception and... Calling voices. And
he was doing a bunch of voice stuff, and then Gandalf showed up. And remember, Gandalf's role in the book was not coming up and cracking the rock. Gandalf's role in the book was imitating the trolls to cause more confusion.
Right.
Gandalf just hid in the bushes and imitated the trolls' voices to start new arguments, which made it a lot more conceivable that the trolls would sit there till sunrise. So the troll scene just didn't really work for me. And the fight, too. Like, it's a problem with this movie that the dwarves are shown to be such badass fighters, but they can't take down three trolls when they're not missing a lick. Like, how are you going to stab them 50 times and they're still good, but then later you want to tell us that one hobbit is able to, not in this, but in Lord of the Rings, you want to tell us that one hobbit is able to single-handedly take down a troll. That doesn't work. You know what I mean? It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
That's just me. True. Back to Radagast for you.
Yes, back to Radagast for you.
Yeah, this, again, he's canon. He exists.
Yeah.
He lived in the southern part of the Greenwood, all that stuff. But honestly, when he said the line, "And these are Rascabel rabbits, I'd like to see them try," it was over for me.
I mean, that's fair. That was a little bit of a cringe moment. That's fair.
And that's completely added in that this is not a thing in the books at all. Radagast is not in The Hobbit. And
I thought he was.
Nope. He never appeared in it. He was actually in the appendices.
He appears in Lord of the Rings, actually.
That's what I'm remembering.
He's referenced, yes.
I'm pretty sure he's actually in it for
I remember him briefly. Being present in something.
He is briefly in Lord of the Rings.
He might have been for like a second to talk to Gandalf or something.
But he is not in The Hobbit, and the strange thing here is with the timeline stuff that they changed dramatically is that, you know, the locals are taking to calling it Mirkwood. This is the first time we've seen these spiders. And in the books, it's like, no.
It's always been.
It's been Mirkwood for a long time now. But I agree. Like, I like Sylvester McCoy, but like,
feels like this is a very explicit attempt at a merchandising play within the movie. I don't know. I don't think it worked at all. But
I did like the Ungoliant reference, though. I did appreciate it.
Sure.
Sure. Rick's like, eh. Well, chased by orcs, Gandalf leads the company through a hidden passage to Rivendell. Which, so, I was telling Samuel that it was cracking me up. Like, comparatively, comparing to the way that everyone looked up to Gandalf in Lord of the Rings, it really, like, it gave me a weird sense of satisfaction, not because I don't like Gandalf, but just to see something different. Thorin's kind of, like, mistrust and, like, a little bit of distaste. Mm-hmm. Like, he respects him because he knows who he is, and so he's like, yeah, okay, we gotta have you here, you're important, but he's not gonna not complain about it. And I found that very, like, weirdly refreshing. Because, again, I love Gandalf, but it was just fun to see a different dynamic between him and the head of the group. Because he and Aragorn had such a, like, kind of, like, bordering on brotherhood. Yeah. Whereas this is very much Thorin's just like, I mean, you're here. You gotta be here. I gotta deal with you.
I think my favorite part is you have Bilbo, who is very, like, abstinent and kind of distasteful towards just the Dwarven Company in general, and then you slowly watch him, like, getting more accustomed, like, getting used to being around them, and then you just have Gandalf's patience slowly diminish as Bilbo's patience gradually grows with the dwarves, and you sit there and just, and there was one line he said where it was like, my patience was going thin with these dwarves.
Which is a good through line, because by the end of the Hobbit book and by the third movie, Thorin and Gandalf are, like, almost coming to blows. So, like, I guess that does work as a through line, but
yeah, I enjoyed that. And so when he was like, yeah, we gotta go through this passage after Thorin had been like, we're not going to Rivendell, and then he's just like, we're at Rivendell! It just cracked me up, watching also, how upset he was.
Which, that was also an addition, right? They were, correct me if I'm wrong, but he didn't trick the company into going to Rivendell in the books. They just went.
Yes. Yeah. Because it was the last, homeliest house.
Yeah, this, and Thorin wasn't, like, thrilled about it, but it wasn't any big thing.
Yeah.
And this whole orc chase is not a thing.
Correct.
Again, orcs are actually not in the books at all. There are no orcs.
They're all goblins.
Yeah. I thought I remembered that, where I was like, why are there orcs here? Like, this feels wrong, but I guess I just forgot about it, because it's been a while.
There were no wargs. There were wolves.
I guess they were just wolves.
I liked the wargs.
But it was the goblins and the wolves.
Unless
no
orcs showed up
books.
At the Battle of the Five Armies.
That's what I'm trying to remember, because Balg, it was said that Balg was a goblin king. Not that he was a Which is so weird that they took the main villain goblin from the book and are like, he's the son of the main villain and he's an assassin. And it's like, what? But...
That's yet another movie.
We're getting ahead of ourselves. Well, there Lord Elrond discloses a hidden indication of a secret door on the company's map of the Lonely Island. Lonely Island? The Lonely Mountain!
Doors, they're from Jamaica, man.
The Lonely Island is a, is like kind of a made up band from SNL. It's like Andy Samberg's thing. Like they did like, I'm on a boat and whatever. So I cannot believe I just said that in reference to Tolkien. My brain just went there. But anyway, on the company's map of the Lonely Mountain, which will be visible only on Durin's Day. Which, as I was, as I'm looking at that, I'm like, dude, they came up with about 50 billion precautions and, like, requirements to be able to find this thing. And for me, I was just like, it's super coincidental that it all lined up here. But I also think I remember that being in the book. So, like, you know, it's a kid's adventure book. I'm not worried about it. But I was just like, awfully coincidental that it's so close.
How convenient. Which I always, my headcanon was always that it wasn't convenient, it was Gandalf.
That's probably fair. But no, I know that the Rivendell stuff was in, you said, the appendix and not in the actual body of the story.
No, Rivendell was real.
Oh, it was in the book?
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Okay. Yeah, that all happened. Didn't remember that.
It was just a reluctance in the method.
Well, Saruman and Galadriel were not there.
Correct. That's from the appendixes. As a matter of fact, I will say one of the things that I actually liked about this movie a lot, especially going back and watching it after Lord of the Rings, is Hugo Weaving as Elrond plays a very different Elrond in this, because Elrond in the book The Hobbit is very different from in Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
He's very nice and he's
mystical.
He's such a good host and he's cracking jokes and all this stuff, and it's completely different from the character we see in Lord of the Rings. And I thought Hugo Weaving actually did a really good job of not being nearly as serious in this movie, but still carrying the same through line of the character that you recognize.
Yeah, as the, you know, sort of like non-Tolkien person, but just rewatched the trilogy, it was very nice to see people I recognized and to walk in and have a little meeting together. I was like, yay, they're back. Like, and, you know, of course, seeing Galadriel just be a level 40 character when everyone else is like 18. Like everything she does is just like off the wall insane. And I was talking to Samuel, because at one point I was freaked out. They show her first and she's wearing this like blue thing, and it's supposed to be like 30 seconds later and she's in a white dress, and I was like, what just happened? Like, did she just change? But no, she had a robe, and I was just freaked out. But
if you want to see more of Galadriel being awesome, go watch Rings of Power.
Oh,
Rick
no.
just shot me a death glare.
That sword.
No, great character. I'm never going to watch Rings of Power, but, you know.
This is the way.
But Gandalf later approaches the White Council, consisting of Elrond, Galadriel, and Saruman the White, and presents a Morgul blade, a weapon of the Witch King of Angmar, which Radagast obtained from Dol Guldur as a sign that the Necromancer is linked to an eventual return of Sauron. So... explain the Necromancer to me. I've never fully understood
the Necromancer.
The Necromancer
just is Sauron.
Okay.
It's just an alias, but it's Sauron. This is all canonical. This is all basic, pretty close.
Before he became Sauron, I forget what his names were throughout history.
So many.
But, you know, he had different strongholds throughout Middle-earth, and this Dol Guldur was one of them at some point. And so... after the Isildur cut his ring off and his spirit is floating around, it kind of coalesced there in Dol Guldur. And that was kind of the first indication that he's back.
Yeah.
Okay.
This
so,
is the first time that Sauron reappears after Isildur cuts the ring 3, off.
In 3,000 years.
This is the first time that he pops back up leading to Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
So, how did he pop back up?
Because he's like Gandalf. He's actually the same as Gandalf. He's an angel.
Yeah,
he's
but...
he's VR. And so he has been slowly regathering power and reforming, and that's the whole thing, right? The descent of the Greenwood into Mirkwood because of Sauron being in Dol Guldur, that is canon. It's just, again, it took place way before The Hobbit. He's gathering power, he's gathering orcs, he's getting the wraiths back with him and all of that. That is all happening in this time period.
Okay.
And this is the first time where he's like, you know what, I think it's time to... We're at the point where I can start revealing myself and I can move to Mordor.
Okay. Yeah, I was just trying to figure it out because that is the thing that has confused me every time. And by that, I mean the one time I've watched these movies.
Every one time.
But, you know, I was sitting there like, who is the necromancer? Like I know it's Sauron, but like, what do you mean? And so the way I'm comparing it in my brain is this is like the embodiment of young Tom Riddle in the Chamber of Secrets is the necromancer for Sauron. Is that kind of accurate?
Well, he's kind of regathering himself, right?
Well, and that's kind of what he's doing in Chamber of Secrets. You know, he's trying to end people's lives so he can take their power.
He's not announcing himself as Sauron.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah. Which, I one small prop that I'll give to these movies, I actually really like how they portray Sauron.
Yeah, that scene at Dol Guldur was...
Oh, that was a cool scene.
Actually,
that was
kind
cool.
of better than anything they do with Sauron in Lord of the Rings. Just saying, just want to put that out there.
Ezric takes a drink.
What we should actually do next time is do the drinking game rules before we start the podcast and then execute them during the podcast.
Maybe we'll save that for the third one in the trilogy that everyone seems to hate.
No one will survive.
I had a good time.
Well, the third one. This is the first one.
Well, I had a good time.
John's like, I already watched all three. But while Saruman presses concern to the more present matter of the dwarves' quest, requesting that Gandalf put an end to it, Gandalf secretly reveals to Galadriel he had anticipated this and had the dwarves move forward without him. Just his normal shenanigans that I love.
Remind me, Rick. Mm. Does Gandalf stay behind in Rivendell?
I believe they leave Rivendell together. He leaves to go investigate Dol Guldur as their head. That was he left at that point to go down to Dol Guldur. I can't say it. The Necromancer's fortress. And then he comes back.
No, because he leaves to go investigate the Necromancer's.
Is that, no, that's when they head into
that's
Mirkwood.
After. Yeah, that's after from Beorn, and then he shows back up at the Lonely Mountain.
Okay, yeah.
That's so when he goes and investigates Dol Guldur.
It's been forever since I read the book.
I'm going to look it up. Y'all can continue.
All right, well, the company journeys into the Misty Mountains, where they find themselves amid a colossal battle between stone giants, which I actually thought that scene was really cool. I believe I said the most cursed thing, though, when it came up. Because I had forgotten about that scene. So Samuel was like, yeah, this was the one I was so excited to, like, you know, see how they did it. And I'm watching it, and I was like, oh, I wasn't expecting rock transformers. And but I honestly, I liked it. I thought it was really cool. But
I thought it was one that they should have left out.
I mean, they could have left it out, but I thought it was fun.
Because of the way they went with this, I thought they should have just left it out, but whatever.
I had fun with it. I liked the big rocks fighting each other. But
why don't we ever see them again? Why don't they ever show up anywhere else in any other Tolkien story?
Well, because that's what I was so confused about. I was like, oh, is this the same place where, like, they had to turn back in the Lord of the Rings trilogy? Like, the mountain that was too dangerous. I was like, is that the same mountain? But apparently it's a different mountain. All these dangerous mountains. but they take refuge in a cave and are captured by goblins who take them to their leader, the Great Goblin, who had a super saggy goiter. Neck.
The Goiter King.
Ugh.
Yeah. It was not pleasant to look at.
I really didn't like the CGI in this movie.
Samuel was making a lot of comments about that, the CGI.
Yeah, it's real rough.
Yeah.
It is real rough.
Well,
starting with the flashback to the Moria battle.
Yeah.
It was just...
Well,
we'll get there, but the eagles kind of looked horrible.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really notice the eagles as much as the orcs, but what I said to Samuel, which I think is true, is that this was also similar to why they made three movies. This is a product of its time. 2012 is peak CGI and everything. Now we're kind of having a return to form with, like, practical being what everyone wants to go back to, because everyone kind of agrees, you know, it's more rewarding, there's more charm to it, and a lot of times it looks better. Like, if you can do practical, do practical. Right. And but in 2012, that was not it. 2012 was, like, kind of Avatar time, you know? Everyone's CGI was so big.
Revolutionary. Nowadays, yeah. You have, like, people are kind of going to, like, the fusion of, like, yeah, practical is better with maybe, like, a pinch of CGI. At certain
yeah, point. Like, CGI whenever you can't do practical.
Right.
But it also makes sense that this wasn't Peter Jackson's passion project, because if it was, he probably would have pushed for practical. But he didn't have time, you know? He was like, we don't have time to build all the things that I would like to build.
To actually, like, build it in pre-production.
Yeah. But I absolutely, you know, because it's 2012, I'm like, we've gotten so used to much better CGI since that time, where, like, even now, going back and watching the first Avatar, it's like, this was revolutionary for the time it came out. Now it's kind of just, like, it's not great. It's not terrible. It's not great. And this is kind of in the same vein, where it's like, at the time, I did not notice that it was rough CGI at all. I was like, this looks great. Everything looks awesome. I think it's awesome. And now I'm looking at it and I'm like, ooh, yeah. You can tell that this was over 10 years ago.
I really noticed it with the wargs. The wargs were...
Yeah.
The wargs were real rough. That's where
I did
really
still like the wargs, though.
You just want one.
I do. I do really want
they
one.
They actually are mounted in D&D. They actually do exist. There is a D&D stat block for them.
Okay, I got distracted. Bilbo becomes separated from the dwarves and falls into a crevice where he encounters Gollum, my favorite, who unknowingly drops a golden ring. Pocketing the ring, Bilbo finds himself confronted by Gollum. They play a riddle game, wagering that Bilbo will be shown the way out if he wins or eaten by Gollum if he loses. Bilbo wins via trickery, and Gollum notices his ring is lost and that Bilbo has it.
Hey. The riddle authorities agreed that it was all on the up and up because Bilbo gave him three guesses. Actually, four guesses.
He gave him a lot of guesses, yeah. But
that is canon.
Did he give him four?
Well, no. That the historians looked back on that event and agreed that in canon, this is in the books. I'm not making this up.
Okay, I believe you.
That they said Bilbo gave him a fair shot because he gave him three guesses at it.
Interesting.
Which I will say, this to me is the highlight, I think the highlight portion of the movie.
Oh, 100%.
The riddles in the dark was so well executed from page to screen. Andy Serkis just showing up and stealing the movie.
Yeah, I mean, what do you expect?
And I love Martin. I mean, Martin Freeman as Bilbo is probably the best performance in the movie, but like...
Him and Andy Serkis together is a force to be reckoned with.
I remember walking out of the theaters being like, man, Gollum. And he's in the movie for 10 minutes, you know? Like,
no, I mean, them together in that scene is just flawless. It's
yeah,
so good.
It's one of... Yeah, it's probably my favorite scene in the whole trilogy.
It was the most engaged that I was for the entire movie. Like, I was watching the whole time, but that was the only moment when I was, like, fully locked in, was that scene with them. So I think it's pretty clear what our favorite moment was. But...
Skip that question.
Martin Freeman just so beautifully captured the... what I always wondered when reading the books, right? Because it seems like Bilbo goes from terrified to, oh, cool, let's play riddles. Right? And Martin Freeman just did such a good job at capturing that. I'm doing this, I'm nervous, but like I feel like this is my best way of getting out. And and Andy Serkis is appropriately like funny but scary, and yeah, it's just...
Well, and the perfect confusion from Martin Freeman with like, you know, he has no clue what's up with this creature, and it keeps like talking to itself and like... Mm-hmm. And my favorite was when he's like, I didn't say anything. And he's like, we weren't talking to you. And just like turns around.
Don't quote me on this, but I believe, and I'm going to look this up, I believe I remember that Andy Serkis actually directed this portion. Because he's second unit director of these films.
Yes.
Mm.
I believe I remember hearing that Andy Serkis directed the Riddles in the Dark sequence.
Maybe.
I'm going to look that up.
It's believable. It is believable for sure. But no, this was an absolutely fantastic scene that I just loved. Because it's cutting between this and them escaping the goblin horde. Yes? Is that right? Timeline-wise in the movie? Like, it's going kind of between the Riddles in the Dark, him running from Gollum afterwards, and the full group running from the goblins.
It's kind of happening at the same time.
Yeah.
Simultaneous.
Yeah, every time it cut back to them doing this, I was just like, yes. It makes me happy. But yes, so chased by the furious Gollum, Bilbo discovers that the ring grants him invisibility. But when he has a chance to kill Gollum, Bilbo spares his life out of pity and escapes. Which, such a good moment with that, where you see how much he wants to, and then, like, he just gets to see all those emotions play across Gollum's face to where he's like, no, not worth it.
I'm not sure that he wanted to as much as he felt like he should.
Yeah.
Like, this was a scenario where it was I'm supposed duty. To kill him. Yeah.
It was like I have to get out of here because I have a job, and the only way I'm going to get out of here is if I kill him, so I have to kill him. But then you see, like, just, you know, the performance of Andy Serkis of just, like, how lost and miserable he is.
Well,
and
of course, Martin never saw that.
Hmm?
Bilbo never saw it. I'm saying the actor, Martin Freeman, never.
Yeah.
He was reacting of to course, something that of wasn't course. There, which is even cooler.
Well, did they do Andy Serkis the same way that they did in the original trilogy?
No, they did performance capture. They didn't do motion capture.
Well, performance capture would mean that he'd be on set doing everything.
Okay. They did that for this one.
But you wouldn't see the full CGI.
No, not the CGI.
But, you know, they're CGIing around Andy Serkis's acting. That's kind of the difference between motion capture and performance capture. Because they did the same thing with Benedict Cumberbatch with Smaug. Where, like, he was making all the expressions as he spoke and moving his body, and then they copied what he did physically into the dragon. Which, that video, if you haven't seen it...
I've seen
it. Oh, it's so good.
So, unclear if he directed the Riddles in the Dark sequence, but he directed the Blunt the Knives sequence. And
nice.
All of the, any aerials and essentially any shots that were not up-close dialogue scenes were him.
Oh, we got some kids screaming outside. Add that to the little... background sounds.
Yay! Anyways, moving on.
Anyway, meanwhile, the great goblin, Saggy Neck, reveals to the dwarves that, is it Azog?
Azog.
Who
is dead!
An orc war chief who killed Thror and lost his forearm to Thorin in battle outside the dwarven kingdom of Moria has placed a bounty on Thorin's head. Gandalf arrives and leads the dwarves in an escape, killing the great goblin. Bilbo exits the mountain and rejoins the company, keeping his newly obtained ring secret. Which, you know, just because of how well he acts it, probably. I know that's just, like, a nightmare in general, is that, like, people don't realize you're there and are just saying terrible things, like, while you're right there. And, like... I felt for him. I was just like, oh, this sucks. Like, you just made it out of this very difficult situation, barely navigated it to get back to your party, and, like, the main guy is just bashing you. Now, it was really just Thorin. None of the others were doing it. But I was just like, ooh, that feels bad. Like, I hate that for you. But the company is ambushed, and this was the moment for me when I was like, this is a long movie, was when they made it out and Bilbo is like, I'm here, you know, and Gandalf's like, I'm so glad to see you, and they all reunite, and then he's like, it's not done, and I was like, oh, I thought it was done, okay, there's more. Like, that was the moment when I was like, oh, this movie's too long.
And this movie's about a half an hour shorter than all the Lord of the Rings films.
Oh my goodness. But that was the moment for me when I was like, okay, it could have ended there. Like, at least for me. Especially since now I know that Azog wasn't even in the books.
Yeah. Well, and this whole sequence was in the books. But it was just the goblins.
Yeah.
Oh.
It was just the goblins chasing them. And I will say, going back to the goblin fight scenes were just so cartoony.
Yes. Video game.
Yeah. It felt,
I don't know if I minded that too much, just because, I mean, for me, it was just easy for me to follow, but...
Well, there were just so many times where it's like, yeah, they're all dead.
That is fair. Right. That is fair.
That last part where that one section of scaffolding or whatever just perfectly falls down that valley down to the bottom. I was like, come on. Stop it.
Well, and they show all the splinters, but everyone's fine. It's like, no, that's how people die or have massive splinters go through their legs and then they bleed out. Like, no, that's...
I mean, that is fair. There were moments when I was like, wow, they got really lucky that that happened at that exact moment. Like,
I rolled a 20. Yeah, it's a 20.
Well, they're ambushed by Azog and his hunting party and takes refuge in the trees. Thorin charges at Azog, who glorious purpose, who overpowers and severely injures him with his warg. Bilbo saves, because, I mean, you're fighting someone on a mount, and it's a very dexterous mount.
Well, not only is it dumb of Thorin, it then leads to one of my least favorite scenes, which is Bilbo taking out a warg and an orc. In what world? I'm sorry. In what world does Bilbo is never a fighter. The only time that he's any good in a fight is when he fights the spiders in Mirkwood.
Right.
That's it.
Now, what I did appreciate...
Samuel, he has to prove himself to Thor.
But he can do that in other ways like he did in the books.
Now, here's the thing. What I did appreciate was not making it seem like Bilbo had skill. So, like, he literally just puts puts Sting in front of him and the warg runs into it.
Oh, no, excuse me. He kills two wargs then, because I forgot about that
warg.
That's
before they jump in the tree.
I'm talking about later when Azog tells the orc, you know, go bring me his head. And the warg and the orc are going to kill Thorin, and Bilbo dives in, kills the warg, and then kills the orc, and then is standing over Thorin's body, like, ugh! And it's like...
I guess I blocked that out. I don't even remember that happening. But I do remember him standing there like, and the warg just ran into it, and then he's like trying to pull it out.
That was funny.
I was like, that tracks with Bilbo. Like, he doesn't know what he's doing.
Well, he's still kind of fought like a little, like, less fighting, more thrashing. But.
Yeah, just like, just put pointy thing in front of me and hope it keeps me safe.
Put the pointy end at the back.
But he saves Thorin from the orcs and challenges Azog, just as the company is rescued by eagles summoned by Gandalf. They escape to the safety of the Kara of the Kerok, where Gandalf revives Thorin, who renounces his previous disdain for Bilbo.
That was it. That was the moment where I said, is that the first time we saw him cast a spell? Because he, like, did something. And
he did, like, cure wounds or whatever, you know? He woke him up real quick. But they seek the lonely mountain in the distance, where the sleeping Smaug is awoken by a thrush knocking a snail against a stone.
And in the strange way of these movies, for all the stuff they added, they cut out a bunch of really good stuff from the books. That's one of the strange things to me. I love the eagle sequence in the books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They go to the eagle's nest. They talk with the eagles. That scene is what a lot of times what I'll point people to when they're like, why didn't the eagles fly them to Mordor? Because the eagles don't care.
They got their own thing going on. Yeah. Like, they're not invested.
And I love that scene in the books, and they cut that. And then we'll talk about it in the next movie. But there's Beorn is such an amazing character in the book. And they just completely just throw him to the wayside in the movies. And it's like, you add so much to these movies, you're looking for so much runtime, but you cut out the good stuff that is already there in the book. Why?
Well, Samuel's gone from liking it to hating it.
I don't hate it, but I did like it far less than I remembered.
Disgruntled.
Yeah.
Disgruntled. Yeah.
Disappointed. I'm disappointed in you, Peter Jackson.
I'm not mad, I'm just disappointed. And the funny thing is, after reading all the behind-the-scenes stuff, I actually don't blame Peter Jackson really at all.
Well, it's not his fault that he came in halfway through and had to just scramble and throw stuff together. It's not his fault. But that was The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey.
Oh, and the end scene with the thrush flying to the Lonely Mountain and starting to knock was very good.
I just love a dragon. Give me a dragon.
I just love dragons.
And I'm happy. Especially
with
if he...
opening his eye.
Yes.
Yeah.
Especially if Benedict Cumberbatch is voicing said dragon, I'll take the dragon. We're good. Well, I went on Amazon. The general consensus is pretty good. 88% of viewers rated it 5 stars. So that's pretty good. Do y'all want positive or negative first?
Let's start with positive.
Yeah. Okay. So
you
I'm
just found my review.
I'm going to be cutting these down a lot because these were the shortest ones I found, and they were still very long because all of these were essays written by the reviewers. So I'm going to cut this down. This is the positive review from Jeff, and it's titled Dear Naysayers, and this was posted in 2013, so like right after it came out. I was blown away. This movie is beautiful. They managed to include elements from The Silmarillion and Unfinished Tales, as well as include elements that did actually happen during The Hobbit, but were only told about in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I appreciate the character development they performed on Thorin, because in the book, he was kind of a jerk. In the movie, the greed and pride in his character is still evident, but so is the nobility and loyalty to his people, making him much more enjoyable and lovable. The acting was superb, of course. Ian McKellen and Martin Freeman proved to be an excellent duo, and the return of Andy Serkis was lovely. To those who haven't seen it yet, enjoy. And then the negative. So this is kind of half negative. I didn't want to go for just like the one stars because they're kind of boring. So I went for a 3-star. So this is from the same year. It's from someone named V. Waldron. I will also be cutting this one down. And it's titled Just Okay. So he says a whole ton of stuff about, you know, about everything that was added and all that. And then that said, the movie is just too long. I was afraid of this when Jackson announced that there was just too much material for 2 films and he was making The Hobbit into 3 films. The Hobbit deviates significantly from the feel of The Hobbit as a book. The book was a lighthearted jaunt with several battle scenes, but with much humor thrown in, more of a children's story, really. On the other hand, the movie emphasizes fight scenes. However, the biggest difference to me is in the characters of Bilbo and the dwarves. Tolkien shows the dwarves to be bumblers, constantly getting into trouble, requiring Gandalf or Bilbo to rescue them time after time. In the movie, Jackson reveals them to be battle-hardened warriors who each can single-handedly take out half an orc regiment. Even Bilbo is pretty handy in his small sword Sting and battles a couple of orcs to a standstill. Large sections of it feel like montages from a video game, but in the end, I did enjoy the movie and will probably watch it again, but it really felt like too little material stretched thin. 3 stars.
Ooh, very, very nice reference there at the very end. Oh. Stretched too thin.
Oh, yeah.
I agree with 90% of that review.
Yeah.
I actually think I do as well.
Well, well, as far as awards, this was nominated for 3 Academy Awards, but I don't believe it actually won any. What do you guys think out of 100, critically, this is rated on Rotten Tomatoes? Don't look at my computer.
I'm going to guess around 80%.
Okay.
75.
Okay.
I'm going to go with 82.
Well, Rick's the closest. It is 64, critically.
Ooh, okay.
Now, audience score out of 100?
75.
Okay.
68.
Okay.
70.
That time Samuel was closest. Audience score is 83.
Idiots.
It's a lot higher. Now, the IMDb score out of 10.
The IMDb score out of 10, I'm going to say 6.1.
Okay.
6.7.
Okay.
6.5?
Rick's the closest. It's higher than you think. It's 7.8 on IMDb. The budget for this was $180 million, and it made $1.017 billion. So it did very, very well. We'll see if that trend stays up with the other two.
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, we'll see. There are really only a couple of fun facts that people didn't, like, already know. Because we all know that, you know, Sir Ian McKellen didn't have a very good time filming this because they didn't do the whole forced perspective, you're on the same set thing.
Mm.
Ian McKellen was on a totally different set with an earpiece. So he didn't get all of the sort of, like, camaraderie of being on set because they were CGIing them.
So that's why they did so many close-ups of him.
Yep. And he hated it.
And like, this, I believe, was the movie where Christopher Lee broke down on set and was like, I can't do this. Because it was... I'm pretty sure that was Christopher Lee, not Ian McKellen. That there's...
No, Ian McKellen almost left. The other cast members did... like so what I have... The other cast members would try to like cheer him up and make him feel better by bringing him like paraphernalia from the original trilogy, or like bringing him like fruit and snacks and stuff to like try to make his day better, because he's just by himself and everyone else is getting to act together and have fun, and he's just miserable all alone. And so they were trying to make him feel better. And what I have here is that he admittedly was initially so miserable having to act in tedious visual effects shots that he seriously gave thought to dropping out, even considering offering Sir John Hurt as his replacement. Because Hurt previously apparently voiced Aragorn in the Lord of the Rings from the 70s.
John Hurt would have been a good Gandalf.
Mm-hmm. So that, it might have been Ian McKellen. Because if he was thinking that seriously about leaving, then that was probably why. I remember
hearing about one of the two of them like having like a breakdown on set, just like looking around at the green screen, acting by themselves, and being like, "I can't do this."
That was definitely Ian McKellen, because Christopher
Saruman's scene was
Saruman's scene was with everybody. Yeah. So it was 100% Ian McKellen, because he was literally just standing in a green screen space, by himself. The only other one that I had was that. Gollum, you know, he appears in only one scene in the book. Andy Serkis completed that scene during the first week of production. And then, of course, stayed on as second unit director.
My man!
But that's all I had. So, who would we cast each other as if we were to recast? And we can cast other people who aren't here if we want.
Tyler's Bilbo.
You think so?
I think Tyler's Bilbo.
I think I agree.
I think I agree with you.
Which dwarf are you?
That's such a good question.
Think John gets to play all the dwarves.
No. I actually think you would be Balin.
I was leaning towards either Balin or Dwalin. I think the Balin. Two halves to you.
Balin.
Balin or Dwalin,
yeah. Yeah, I think Balin is the one I would put you as.
I mean, Rick is Gandalf.
100%. Easy money.
Danielle's Gollum.
Yes. That's all I ever want to be. And then Samuel, I think you are... He doesn't have a big...
Colton is Thorin.
Colton is 100% absolutely. Thorin. 100%.
You know what? Weird take. I think I'm Dwalin. I think you're Balin.
I can actually go with that.
I can also see that.
Yeah, you've got that kind of like, you know, wizened, I'm going to sit here and tell you about things even though I'm the youngest one in the room that you do sometimes. No, I can see that.
And the difference between you and Colton for that.
That is the first time in my life I've ever been described as wizened.
Well, because like...
At 24 years old.
Yeah, you had that birthday, so now you're old.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now you're old. Okay, Rick, I know you've been prepared for it. What's the drinking game?
Oh, God, I have no idea. I should have prepared.
We need take a drink, finish your drink, and shot.
Take a drink every time they make a food joke with Bomber.
Oh, they do that a lot. Yeah.
But not enough.
No, they don't do it enough where you're going to, like, die. So, that's a good take a drink. Maybe finish your drink when Gandalf uses obvious magic. Because he only does it a couple times.
Right. I mean, take a shot anytime a warg dies on screen.
No.
That's so much.
That'd be like six shots.
That's a lot of shots.
The elves murk the wargs.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that scene, actually.
What would be a good shot?
I mean, anytime the elves as a collective appear on screen?
Every time they play the Misty Mountain song.
Oh my gosh.
That's take a drink. Actually.
That should That's be the take a drink. Drink is
take a drink
that...
every time they play the Misty Mountains theme.
Well, and then the shot could be every time they make a food joke with him, because that's not too crazy. It's like maybe four times.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, we could do that. But the Misty Mountain theme, that's absolutely drink every time that plays. Oh my gosh, that's a good one. Well, favorite and least favorite moments from this one.
Favorite is Riddles in the Dark.
100%.
Least favorite is... It might be Bilbo killing the orc in the warg.
Okay.
Because it just felt so antithetical to the book and to him as a character.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's also very contradictory to the scene he just had about, like, the methodical, like, I can't kill this guy. And he's totally fine just working a warg and an orc, like, 5 minutes later.
Like I said, I think my favorite was when the dwarves are singing over the Misty Mountains. I gotta say my least favorite is the escape from Goblin Town.
The Escape from Goblin Town. Okay, John?
My least favorite is just the Goblin King, just as the Great Goblin, whatever that guy's name is. He, like, I get it, he's a goblin, but, like, does he have to look that unpleasant to look at?
There like, were a few things in this that were unpleasant was, to look at. You'll hear like, mine in a second.
I was like, ugh, that's... Can we not? Like, hated it. Honorable mention goes to... because I've had the honorable mentions. Goes to the scene where the dwarves are like being surrounded by the elven guard, and they're all defensive. And Elrond says something to them completely in Elvish, and they get all defensive immediately, ready to fight everyone in the room. And it's like, what did he say? And it's like, he asked if y'all wanted food. And it's like, we're in. But I will say, I think one of my favorite moments is just the Bilbo, I think Bomber's walking by with like 4 blocks of cheese.
Oh, yeah.
And Bilbo's like, do you need a cheese grater? And then I forget which dwarf it is, but one of the dwarves walks by and goes, no, he eats it by the block. I don't know why. That just tickled me so much. And I'm normally not that easily gotten with food humor, but it's just the fact that the man has the 4 giant wheels of cheese.
That's the actor that I love, though. Oh, he eats it by the block? That's James Nesbitt.
Oh, okay.
Love that actor.
Well,
him in the Stephen Moffat show Jekyll is chef's kiss.
Well, my least favorite has to be whatever gross like bird poop was on Radagast's face.
Mm, fair.
That was so hard to look at. I hated it. I was not a fan. And then my favorite is Riddles in the Dark, but just to pick something different, because I was thinking about it while we were watching it, I really liked this one scene, which was the just Gandalf and Galadriel scene. Right before he leaves, where he's talking about, like, you know, I find that, you know, the most power and strength comes in these small things, the everyday, you know, the things that aren't as fantastical and epic.
That's
the
really
like, I really liked that monologue and the way he performed it.
Very
Tolkien-ish. Yeah, it was very. And I was a big fan of that. So if I have to be different from Samuel, that would be what I would pick. But, of course, Riddles in the Dark is absolutely my favorite. So, let's see. Out of 10 poorly CGI'd wargs, what would you rate An Unexpected Journey?
I've actually thought quite a bit about this. If 5 is a perfectly average movie, I think I'm going to give this a 6.5.
Okay. Okay.
Because it is, in my opinion, I think slightly above average as a film, just in comparison to Lord of the Rings and other good fantasy films, it falls short, far short. But it is enjoyable to watch. I was entertained.
Okay. Whoever's next?
I think we'd give this like 8.7 wargs.
Partial wargs.
Partial wargs. Just the first half of the warg. But no, I think overall entertained me. It was fun to watch. And again, I had the benefit of watching this before I watched the Lord of the Rings movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have all this, you know, y'all like, oh, the Frodo is in excess. Like, I didn't... Obviously, I knew Elijah Wood played Frodo, and I knew who they were referring to, but it's like, I didn't see it as excess. And I'm also not encumbered with the... I haven't read The Hobbit or the Lord of the Rings books. So I didn't have that lore and that knowledge prior that what's been added, what's been taken away. I just had a good time watching dwarves be dwarves on screen.
That's the most John thing.
I got what I asked for, and I'm not disappointed. But I will say, bit long. There could have been parts that could have been taken out that were unnecessary. But anywho, that's my 2 cents.
Yeah, I have too much trouble separating my Tolkien knowledge from the movie. I just can't do it. So, I mean, if 5 is an acceptable movie, this is a 4.
Oh, it's going to get so bad. Okay.
It's going to get so much worse.
I have to give this one a 4. because I know what's coming.
Because you have to have somewhere to go.
Yeah, I just between all of the stuff they added in and the CGI, which was just so bad, and all of that, there were good moments. Like I said, the dwarven singing, the riddles in the dark, those were good. But four is as high as I could go with this.
Okay. For me, I'm a little more in kind of John's camp of like, yes, I've read the books, but read almost all of them. But I read this one.
Do you know how many books there are about Tolkien?
I know there's a bunch. About and
Tolkien? Well, I mean,
well, what Tolkien's I, world. What I mean is of the trilogy and the Hobbit. Not the Silmarillion, so not many. Unfinished Tales, none of that. I've read
History
most of
Middle Earth's Volume oh my one gosh. From like nine.
No, I've read most of Lord of the Rings and I've read The Hobbit, and so, but I've done each of that just once, you know. And as we know with me, as I've discussed, watching or reading things, unless I watch it like over and over and over and over, or I read it a million times, it's not really going to stick with me in the details. What's going to stick with me is usually just the overarching plot. And maybe a couple of moments that like come up when people talk about it. And I'm like, oh yeah, that did happen. You're right.
So what was Harry Potter wearing the third day back from Christmas break his first year at Hogwarts?
Probably his Hogwarts robes because he's back in school. but...
I know she's read those.
Oh, 100%. I have read them, but I actually need to reread them. It's been a minute now. I gotta stay sharp, but unless I watch a ton of stuff or read a ton of stuff, I don't retain a whole ton of detail. And so watching this, I was like, yeah, I know they're adding a bunch of stuff and some stuff does seem different. Cause I did realize the troll scene was different. I just didn't quite know how, certain things were changed, but for me, it didn't really hinder too much of my enjoyment of it. Cause similar to John, I was able to just kind of have a good time. But, everyone's dropping their phones. I did it a minute ago. But I think I would rate this like a 7.5. Not quite as high as John, but I did enjoy it. I had a good time with it. It ended and Samuel was like, I didn't like that as much as I wanted to. And I was like, I had a fun time. Like, you know, it wasn't a perfect movie and it wasn't like something that I'll necessarily seek back out. Hence why it's only a 7.5. But I did have a good time with it. And that's really all I can ask for movies that I kind of know about, but I don't have a whole lot of emotional investment. But I think that's just about it, unless anyone has anything they haven't said before we get out of here.
The only thing I'll add is, you know, and I think I may have mentioned it on one of the other Lord of the Rings podcasts we did, but 1977, I was, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old when The Hobbit movie came out on CBS.
Yeah.
Okay. And it was a 90-minute long animated movie. And it told this story perfectly. And that's when I went to my sister and I said, this was a great movie. She said, oh, here's the book. You should read the book. So this started my adventure into just reading and fantasy and everything. And so that's part of the reason why I kind of resent this movie.
Well, because you've got a ton of emotional investment tied to that book and the original movie.
That's fair.
Yeah, so y'all have to watch the 90-minute. We can even get Tyler to pay attention for 90 minutes to watch an animated Hobbit movie.
I don't believe that.
Tyler from the Peanut Gallery.
We're gonna tie him to a chair and force him to watch that. And it's going to be epic.
Oh, is he going to run in?
I think not.
Well, we are going to close out this series with that, I believe. But I guess now that we're getting out of here, only things we got to let y'all know about are Heather's auditions are coming up at the end of May. May 30th, 31st, and June 1st. So once signups get posted for that, they, for all I know, by the time this is posted, they'll be up. But
they'll be up beginning of April.
You heard it here.
I'm going to be Heather.
He's going to be...
But which Heather?
All three. You cloned Rick.
Heather.
I would watch that. You playing all three Heathers.
Heather, a one-man show.
That would be...
Oh, that's so good. But yes, auditions are going to be... audition sign-ups will be posted beginning of April, so be looking out for that on our social media, Instagram and Facebook, at Mad Artist Entertainment. We also, by the time this goes up, at least the first episode of Ghosts of Salt Marsh will be posted, yes. Both on YouTube and in a podcast form, everywhere else, not video form, but you know, there'll be a little nice thumbnail to look at while you listen to the podcast. But the first episode's going to be coming out, in just a few days from when we record this. So definitely be checking that out. We'll be posting about it on our social media as well and where you can go and find it. If you have any comments, questions, corrections, or suggestions, you can email us at bannerbox.madartists@gmail.com or just send us a message. Leave us a review wherever you're listening. It helps us out a ton. And we will see you guys next time. Bye!
Bye!
Bye-bye!